Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We have a return guest, very, very timely return guest, Donald Ayer, former U.S. Deputy Attorney General under George H.W. Bush, who had a widely read, widely talked about piece in The Atlantic the other day. Bill Barr must resign. He argued the Attorney General is working to destroy the integrity and the independence of the Justice Department in order to make Donald Trump a president who can operate above the law. So thanks for returning. I appreciate it very much, Mr. Ayer.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you and I were on a cable show the other day, and of course, on cable TV, you get to talk for like 4 minutes. But we'll let you actually have complete thoughts here. That's the thing about podcasts.
I very much appreciate it.
Well, so the President of the United States, before we get to your piece, the President of the United States declared that he was the chief law enforcement officer in the country as he issued a series of pardons, and this may be a little bit separate from the other things we're talking about. But the president, flexing his almost infinite power to pardon, commuted the sentences of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, former New York City Police Commissioner Bernie Kerik, who lied to the FBI, cheated on his taxes, the former owner of the San Francisco 49ers, 1980s junk bond king Michael Milken, who by the way, apparently this was something that was being pushed by a billionaire who hosted a $10 million fundraiser for the president just on Saturday. And of course, this comes on top of the pardons of Joe Arpaio and Dinesh D'Souza. It is interesting for a president who has been took out a multi-million dollar ad on the Super Bowl touting criminal justice reform to basically be handing out to these get out of jail free cards to a bunch of his cronies, well-heeled buddies, campaign donors, etc. But there's no question that the president's power to pardon is pretty close to absolute, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and I think these pardons are an interesting example of here comes one more thing from the president, which often you're constantly getting barraged by things, and this particular one is quite a bit different than the things that we were talking about just before these were done about the Justice Department, which I think there's some very conclusive things to say. It does seem odd, certainly, and these are high-profile people, and things they did were not terrific. But A, you don't really know the merits of a pardon decision until you really get into the facts, and not many people I know have gotten too far into the facts. I know I certainly have not. And at the end of the day, the best practice probably is to use the pardon attorney in the Justice Department and get good advice and thoughtfulness into the process and, do it that way. But there's no obligation to do that. In fact, many presidents have offered pardons, given pardons on their own and in various situations. And that is the president's prerogative. So the only thing I would caution against, A, whether or not they made sense, whether they're fair is an issue, and people can think about that and maybe should. But you can't just say because the president did this, and I've heard of these people, that that's a terrible thing. And you certainly can't say, oh, that's another example of the Justice Department's misbehavior. You don't know. I mean, I really don't have any idea if it is or it isn't. But I really don't want to dwell on it. If to the extent we want to focus on the Justice Department, boy, there's a lot to talk about. And there is a lot of stuff that I think is quite conclusive that the department is being misrun in a very serious way. And then this isn't really part of it, I think.
There's very little evidence that the Justice Department had any involvement in this. And why use the Justice Department's pardon attorneys when you have Fox News? Although, yeah. As Kim Whaley points out, though, today in the Bulwark, after today, the pardon is pretty clear. The pardon power is going to operate as an openly political tool for presidents to dangle and use during their terms for purposes of shaping and motivating political loyalty. So even though this is completely separate from all of this, it's also clearly seems to send a signal to anybody else that's involved in the criminal justice system or under investigation. We're talking about General Flynn or Roger Stone or Paul Manafort.
True, yeah.
That this is a president who is prepared to reward loyalty. Yeah, and this was part of the Mueller investigation, the suggestions that there might be pardons, the use of pardons to obstruct justice, the use of pardons to reward someone for refusing to testify or to cooperate with the Department of Justice. So this is one of those moments, again, where the president is within his constitutional powers to do it, but it is deeply troubling if we're concerned about the rule of law.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. It certainly may be if you look at those facts and the reasons why they were done. If you know what they are, I just don't happen to know the details of that. But I agree with you.
So the other day, the Attorney General went on ABC, and he complained that the president tweeting about ongoing criminal justice and cases was making it impossible for him to do his job. And the president responded by tweeting about these ongoing cases. In fact, in the last day or two, he's been attacking the judge, been pushing for a new trial for Roger Stone. And there was some speculation that it was almost as if the president was trying to force Bill Barr's hand. Say, okay, you know, you laid down your marker. I'm picking it up. You either resign or what? Prove that that was all a bluff. So what is your take on the on Barr's interview and the way the president reacted to it?
Well, I don't know whether it was sort of prearranged and planned ahead or what, but and I also don't know whether. Maybe it was a genuine effort by Barr to get the president to not tweet, which if it was, apparently it failed. The most important thing to me about it is that, and I've had a couple of people say to me, gee, don't you think we ought to give him some credit for protesting? And my immediate reaction was, heck no, absolutely not. I mean, he did not say word one about changing the course of policy or the course of actions, which has been, you know, very consistently over a long time in many, many contexts to use the department's machinery and to intervene in personal ways to protect the president, to eliminate or minimize the checks, including the constitutionally explicit checks and balances on the president. It's been a complete pattern going back, at least actually goes back before, but the most memorable first step was when he whitewashed the Mueller report, and that was in March. And coming forward, we can go sort of week by week and month by month and all the things he's done, and it's been just a systematic effort to do that. One interesting, apropos of the president's own statements, one of the things that I find the most telling is that the president's statements that he has the power to do this, which he said as recently as yesterday, but he said it, I think, a bunch of times before, that he has the power to do this. Oh, but I didn't interfere, but I have the power to interfere and essentially decide these cases because I'm the chief law enforcement officer of the country. Bill Barr told him that. This is direct advice from Bill Barr. He is doing
nothing.
Where did
he get that idea?
Yeah, well, that's right. And so, you know, the place that we know Bill Barr told him, he's probably told him other places, but that memo that Barr wrote back in June of 2018 when he was telling Rod Rosenstein and I guess the Trump people in general that the Mueller investigation, this is before the report, the Mueller investigation was totally off base. And there was simply no basis on which you could think the president might be obstructing justice in a federal criminal investigation of any sort, because the president is the executive branch. And as the executive, the indivisible executive branch, the president has total control. This is virtually Barr's literal words. The president has total control over all aspects of the Justice Department, including its criminal investigations. And he went on to say that Congress wouldn't have the power to prevent the president from taking control and indeed terminating an investigation of himself. And so the president, as outrageous as his statements sound, he's just repeating what Barr has said to him, which is to say, Bill Barr is un-American, which is to say, this is not the system we all know. This is a banana republic. This is not our system of the rule of law.
But, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, isn't Bill Barr right? Now, there's a piece in the Washington Post today by a law professor from South Texas School of Law in Houston named Josh Blackman. I don't know if you know him. He wrote a book called Introduction to Constitutional Law. Anyway, so he is pushing back on this, and he writes, he quotes you, and says, you know, Donald Ayer, who served as Deputy Attorney General under President George H.W. Bush, wrote in the Atlantic magazine of Barr's complicity in the sentencing shift. He's referring to the Roger Stone prosecution. And then he quotes you saying, given our national faith and trust in a rule of law that no one can subvert, it is not too strong to say that Bill Barr is un-American. Now, this is what Blackman writes. Un-American? Absolutely not. Unconstitutional? Not even close. Unwise? Yes. As a policy matter, the president should stay out of sentencing decisions, especially those involving his friends. But the president is correct that he has the legal authority to intervene in the case. The Constitution does not create a wall of separation between the president and the Justice Department. To the contrary, the Constitution vests the executive power in the president, and the decision whether and how to prosecute someone ultimately belongs to the president. Now, that's really quite extraordinary for a layman to read.
Right.
He's saying that under the Constitution, the president can say, this is how I want this criminal case handled. This is what I want you to do with this defendant. So is he right?
Well, so this takes us back to some very interesting issues that, you know, that relate, the two things they relate to are they relate to Watergate and the reforms that followed Watergate. And they also relate to debates that began, as far as I'm aware, in the Justice Department and around the government that I'm aware of. They started really in the 80s in the Reagan administration under the heading of the unitary executive. And in the 80s and later on as well, there were lawsuits and some went to the Supreme Court about, well, what does it mean to say we have a unitary executive? Obviously, everyone agrees we have one president and we have one executive branch. And a number of these cases dealt with the question of to what degree Congress has the ability to limit or curtail the president's control over certain things. And the focus in a lot of them was independent agencies, things, places like the SEC and the NLRB and a number of them, where officials are put in place on terms that they are subject to removal for misconduct or for certain kinds of behavior or in certain situations, but they were not generally removable summarily by the president. There's a bunch of different variations on this that curtail to some degree the president's level of control. And do those violate the concept of a unitary executive or not? And the cases are varied, and they kind of draw a wavy line that is, you know, subtle. And the answer is, yes, it's true. There is a degree to which if you pass it, you've violated the president's ability to control his government. But for example, the independent counsel statute that used to exist in the Morrison v. Olson case decided in the 80s, the court, by a vote of, I think, 8-1, Scalia being the only dissent, upheld that statute. And it had an independent counsel who was subject to removal for misconduct, but virtually nothing else, as I recall. And the Supreme Court said that's good enough. That's enough control for the president to have. So the answer is not quite as categorical on a constitutional level as Mr. Blackman suggests. But the second part of it, and this is the most important part of it, I think, is that since Watergate, Watergate was a bad situation because we ended up with a lot of public distrust in the government. And Edward Leavy from the University of Chicago was brought in to essentially restore trust. And he recognized that the centerpiece of trust was the recognition that we have a rule of laws and not men, as he put it, and that no person be above the law. And so he instituted a lot of measures that were aimed to achieve that, and they were enormously successful. And a lot of people, including me, who came along out of law school just as that was happening, and people who've come along later and worked in the Justice Department, have very much appreciated the fact that they work for an institution that is highly principled, thought to be accurately, I think, for most times, free from political interference, principled, diligently in pursuit of fairness, which is a hard thing to achieve. You got to work hard at it. You got to be willing to be second-guessed by other people and think hard about it. But the key part of it is that there be no reality or even, and this is critical, an appearance of political considerations being injected, personal bias being injected, deliberate efforts to treat certain people differently or more favorably than others because they're your friends, or worse, because they're your enemies, and a norm that has developed and been, I think, virtually uniformly adhered to up to now. And thus, it's a governing norm that all have respected up to now, is that the White House stays out of individual handling of criminal matters. And certainly, beyond any imagination, it stays out of any such matters relating to people who are, you know, colleagues or friends or enemies or anything else of the president. So presidents have been satisfied and happy to recognize the value to our institutions to respect a wall of separation for certain purposes. It's very important to say that last thing because, yes, it's true. The Justice Department is part of the executive branch. The Attorney General's in the cabinet. There are many policy issues that the department deals with on antitrust issues and there, you know, a whole lot of different questions that the department's involved in that the president has policy input into, certainly, without doubt. But what's developed and what's been respected for 45 years is a norm where the White House and political considerations in general are kept scrupulously out of the criminal process, whether it's charging or sentencing or anything else. So the biggest breach here clearly is the breach of that norm, and it's a norm that has benefited us enormously for almost a half a century.
So this was, you know, four decades, nearly five decades, but it was a norm, not something that is written in the Constitution, not something that is really codified in statute. So are we now entering a post-norm era where we had this period in our constitutional life that lasted from about 1970, 1974 to 2019, 2020? So what era are we in now?
Well, you know, that I think it remains to be seen. And I think we're in the middle of that discovery right now. And I continue to be hopeful that the public will recognize the importance of this. I would very much like to see lawyers in the country beyond the ones who signed that letter. Last I heard it was like 2,200. I'm not sure where it is now who've signed that letter. Lawyers from the Justice Department have signed that letter. Well, you know, there's a lot of other people who are intimately involved in the legal process, citizens in general, but more directly lawyers and judges. I'm hopeful that organizations of lawyers and perhaps even of judges will choose to speak out on this issue. I mean, it's not a partisan question when you examine in detail, as I've tried to do in that article, the conduct that Bill Barr has engaged in, and even more directly and strikingly, the language that he's used to describe his purposes. It's a shocking, shocking thing to people who have mostly, you know, in this era, 45 years later, mostly grown up in a country that assumed and believed and was very happy to know that our system of justice, and particularly in the criminal area, is even-handed and fair, and no person gets to call the shots in an unfair way. And the idea that Bill Barr literally wants and believes we need, and I'm still curious to know quite why he thinks this, but he really thinks we need a government. Maybe he thinks it's needed for national security reasons or international relations. I don't know what it is, but he thinks we need a government in which the president is essentially able to do anything he wants and not be checked in any meaningful way by the existing checks that exist, whether they be in the constitutional checks and balances or whether they be the norms that have developed and served us so well.
You mentioned this letter that's now been signed by more than 2,200 former DOJ employees. And then we had a report, I want to get your insight into this, which I didn't fully understand, this report of this emergency meeting of this Association of Federal Judges, which apparently has been called to deal with this. What do you know about that? And does it actually matter? What's the significance of those two developments?
Well, the letter, I think, the letter is significant because these are people, like me who have worked in the Justice Department in the last half century, and they understand the significance of this because they know what it meant in their own work, or does mean in their own work, to either you work under a regime where you're really working hard and taking a great pride in trying to be fair to people and trying to be even-handed, or in fact, you work in one where the fix can be put in by somebody at the top whenever they want to do it. And so that's a real expression by people who understand why it matters. The judge meeting issue, again, this is one of these things where you hear the report and you're left to speculate about it. I mean, it seems fair to guess that the judges are not happy with this. Judges, though, are judicious. They are careful. They are reserved. They don't run around lightly making political statements. So what will come out of that, if anything, I don't know. And I realize it's a very sensitive thing. And I think also very sensitive is the district court, Judge Jackson, and the district court in general here in the District of Columbia, handling the challenges they're seeing with regard to the Roger Stone sentencing today and the Flynn case. I guess it's tomorrow, not today, but they're being very careful, but they're trying to protect themselves. So I don't know if we're going to hear anything public from these judges, but they're plainly trying to circle the wagons and figure out what if anything they should be doing, because I know they must be upset about it.
They're in a tough position because, of course, there's tremendous, speaking of norms, norm against the federal judiciary getting embroiled in partisan politics.
Right.
And they obviously do not want to do that and do not want to be perceived to do that. And yet it's difficult to know, how do you push back against these encroachments without running the risk of looking like you're taking a partisan political position or a political position of some sort.
Right. Well, I think it's very hard for judges. I think that's why we all need to be looking out for judges in their role, because they've assumed a neutrality and an even-handedness that is very much detracted from if they have to become advocates in the public sphere for a position or advocates against the desecration of their work. I mean, that's a very difficult and almost in some ways self-defeating thing. And yet, what are you supposed to do when someone takes aim at you like this? And I think the answer of what you're supposed to do is what we're going to see when Judge Jackson goes through with the sentencing tomorrow. And I'd be very interested to watch that. But I think what we're going to see is a highly principled judge who will not much respond to what's gone on, who will take on board what she knows from what's been filed with her, and she will do the job of a judge, and she will even-handedly announce the sentence, which I understand is still the plan, even though there's motions before her, and it will not be a display of anger in any way by the judge. And nobody should interpret that as meaning that the judge is pleased or even okay with what's been done. She's a judge. She's got to act like a judge. She will act like a judge. And that's what we all have to hope for and be proud of. But it doesn't mean that this is a good situation or even a remotely acceptable situation.
Okay, I want to get to your piece where you call for the resignation of Bill Barr. But did we get a counter indicator last week on Friday, the day after Barr goes on television and tells the president to stop tweeting because it's making his job hard? The Justice Department then announces 24 hours later, essentially, that they are dropping the prosecution of Andrew McCabe. Big priority for the president to go after the former acting FBI director. McCabe had been fired. The president was obviously obsessed with this prosecution, and McCabe clearly did engage in some, I would say, misleading conduct in talking with the FBI about a certain media leak. So how do you read the fact that Bill Barr's Justice Department was willing to subject itself to President Trump's wrath by letting Andrew McCabe off the hook? I mean,
we're once again in the realm of speculation about what they may have been doing. But I think, again, what's important to do is to look at that action in the context of A, the handling of that case previously, and B, the other circumstances that we have in front of us. The McCabe investigation of kinds of issues like that the track record of turning episodes that resemble that at all into a criminal prosecution is virtually non-existent. I mean, that's basically not something that's been done that I'm aware of. And the idea that it sat around as a criminal investigation for 2 years is appalling. I don't know what they were waiting for other than the fact that they were reluctant to get rid of it because they'd get yelled at by the president, because it wasn't a case that on any scale of reasonable decision-making could plausibly have been brought as a criminal case. So they finally, after 2 years, dump something that probably never should have been looked into after the first week or two. But the other issue is, okay, so this comes along in the context of a series of things which are giant intrusions into the normal way of doing business. First, we have the changing of the sentencing recommendation with regard to Stone. Then we have indications that we're going to be sort of reassessing the usual and ordinary handling of the Flynn case, and that's being looked at now. And also in the midst of all this, and I forget exactly where the McCabe announcement came, but it was a little bit of salt to go with this other pepper, I think, where the last thing was, or one of the last things at least, was Barr announcing that he had a committee of worthy souls who he trusted, who were now going to be overseeing an undefined number that I'm aware of other investigations that the career prosecutors in the department are handling. So you have a tremendous injection of political influence and consideration into the overall handling of cases which somehow or other are deemed to be sensitive. And I guess the common denominator is they're perhaps of interest to the president and the administration on some personal basis. And all of that is shocking and a flagrant violation of the norm that I was talking about earlier, where, hey, look, we let the processes work. Just one thing I want to add about the processes. So the Watergate reforms that Attorney General Leavy put in place involved a lot of different things. And one of them was the idea that the department has such power that its actions actually should be deemed to have what he referred to as a judicial nature. You have power as a prosecutor to ruin someone's life by just prosecuting them, even if they aren't convicted, you know, what they're going to be put through, what McCabe was put through for 2 years, what other people probably are being put through right now by this phony criminal investigation that Barr and Durham are conducting, which is totally redundant. Not totally. It's not totally redundant. It's mostly redundant of the IG investigation into the FBI Russia probe, Russia interference. So they have a separate one that Barr's been, you know, periodically, I guess, been flying off to Italy to help Durham pursue. It's a criminal case, unlike the IG case, which was administrative. So you have people sitting around wondering what is going to become of them, or what are they up to? And we're waiting for all of those shoes to fall. So all of this stuff that's going on, which is in the minds of most reasonable people who have enjoyed life under the Watergate reforms, tremendous intrusion of politics into the very sacred and very powerful processes of the criminal sanction. And in the context of that, they found it in their heart to terminate a 2-year investigation that probably never should have existed. So I don't give it a whole lot of weight in terms of a positive step that they took.
Okay, let's talk about your piece in The Atlantic. You open up by reminding everybody that when Trump named Bill Barr, there were high expectations. There were even some moderates and liberals who thought this was a great choice, maybe particularly in contrast to the really unfortunate acting attorney general who was there in place. And there were people who thought that he was going to stand up for the department's institutional prerogatives. And this is the way he was sold to a lot of folks, that he was an institutionalist. I mean, how bad could he be? He was attorney general under George H.W. Bush. Did you work together at the same time? You were not his deputy, correct?
No, I was the deputy. I was the deputy when he was the head of OLC in 1989 and 90, and I left in 1990, and he became the deputy at that point. So I knew him. I had some interaction with him. I did not have a lot of interaction with him. I've actually known him a very long time, but I do not know him well, and I wouldn't claim to. But I do know from the time that I was there then, and from what's happened since, something about his views. And his views back then, I think, were quite similar to his views today. They were views that, for whatever set of reasons, the Constitution should be understood as creating a very, very powerful chief executive. And Winbar was in OLC 30 plus years ago, 89 and 90. He was the author of a number of opinions that in various ways tried to restrict and limit intrusions on the president of various sorts. There's a pretty famous memo that he wrote to the other the heads of the other departments of the executive branch, targeting ways that he said Congress was infringing on their discretion and sort of plotting a strategy to resist what Congress was doing. But the really important thing to know about all of that, so Barr had a lot of interest in those issues and pursued it, and he wrote a lot of opinions, and some of those opinions, a number of them have been cited now this year under in opinions that are have been issued to related to the stonewalling that they're doing in various ways and a number of other things. Bill Barr's opinions have been sort of enshrined as the legal authority for things that they're doing now. But back to your question about, so wasn't he an institutionalist as attorney general? Well, George H.W. Bush, as everyone knows, was not someone who aspired, shall we say, at all to be an authoritarian president. He was a very traditional Republican president who respected the appropriate limits on governmental power, who who really was a traditional Republican.
And this is what's so striking, yeah, is the contrast. You have the opposite. And you want to talk about somebody who is temperamentally the polar opposite of Donald Trump, it would be George H.W. Bush.
I think that's right.
So that's the cognitive dissonance, that the same person can be attorney general for someone who is so traditional and so respectful of these limits and guidelines, and then move to be the consigliere for Donald Trump.
Well, but I think the important thing is, we know he had these ideas because he spoke about them and he wrote opinions about them. But as attorney general, he wasn't driving the train. The president was driving the train, and that train was not heading toward a dictatorship. That was not what the agenda was. And Barr, at the head of the Justice Department, was not in a position to steer it there. And what I think we now see, without any doubt, and I would go that far as to say without any doubt, is we have Barr as the thoughtmeister behind legal moves that are going forward now. And the president, the best thing that Donald Trump has going for him, if indeed his goal is to achieve the state which he says he aspires to, which is I can do anything I want to, up to, I guess, and including somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue, I'm not sure. But in any event, he can do whatever he wants unchecked by the rest of the government. Well, Bill Barr is able now, with Donald Trump as his foil, to pursue his lifelong ambition of a government where the president is essentially unchecked. And if you look at the list of things he's done this year, and the worst of them are these criminal intrusions lately, but that's only the tip of the iceberg. It's a shocking collection of steps that have been taken that are dismantling the tradition and the system of checks and balances that we've got.
So the real point that I took away from your piece, which I believe sort of hit me, was the tweets are not the problem. It's not these random interventions. Bill Barr has had a consistent view of the law, and as you point out, it really shouldn't come as a surprise that as Attorney General he's returned to a familiar theme. And, of course, there was also, and you mentioned in your piece, this tell that I'm not sure that many Trump skeptics took as seriously as they should have. There's this 19-page memorandum that he sent to Rod Rosenstein attacking the Mueller investigation. At the time, when I first heard about it, I thought, this is a resume. This is a job application. And a job application for somebody that is going to be Donald Trump's Roy Cohn. And people didn't take that. I don't think they took it seriously enough, what the implications of that. But when you, as you put it together, when you go back to the things that he has done and written over the years, you put it into context of this 19-page pro-Trump, anti-Mueller memorandum, then we really shouldn't be shocked by the kind of attorney general he has been and where it's going.
Well, that's right. That's right. And I would just add one more. You're absolutely correct. I mean, it's completely predictable. And I don't think one can accuse Bill Barr of not sticking by his guns and following through on what he said he would do. I think what you can accuse him of is pretty serious dishonesty in terms of the way he argues for getting the things done he wants. You know, and there's a bunch of examples of that. But the one thing to know is that this was not a secret at the time he was confirmed. There was a professor at Georgia, I think a University of Georgia Law School named Neil Kinkoff, who testified, I believe, and he testified at length and very effectively about Barr's views. And it included a discussion of this memo. And somehow or other, that was utterly lost on the Senate reviewing his nomination. But this was not a secret. This was all known. And what I guess carried the day for a lot of people was, oh, well, he was attorney general. He was attorney general under George H.W. Bush. And that was completed, you know, in a respectable way. There were no disasters that occurred. And don't we really need an institutionalist now? And he must be an institutionalist because certainly George H.W. Bush was an institutionalist. So what the heck? Let's take him and go with it. And if people had thought a little harder, they would have realized that they were actually going to get the Bill Barr that had been the Bill Barr who was there then and has been there ever since. And we know it from what he says and what he does.
And of course, it did feel at the time to some people like it would be an improvement to have an actual attorney general as opposed to Matt Whitaker, who was, you know, right. Both a joke and kind of scary given what he was capable of doing. This was one of the first disagreements we have internally at the Bulwark because I've always been a Bill Barr skeptic and there were people who were like, no, he's going to be okay. Right. He's going to be the adult in the room. Okay. So your last paragraph in this Atlantic piece, Bill Barr's America is not a place that anyone, including Trump voters, should want to go. It is a banana republic where all are subject to the whims of a dictatorial president and his henchmen. To prevent that, we need a public uprising demanding that Bill Barr resign immediately or, failing that, be impeached. Now, we are getting these letters from former DOJ employees, and there is some speculation that maybe Barr is you know, telling people that he might resign, which I don't take that at face value at all. It is highly unlikely that he's going to be impeached. So, you know, barring a resignation, where are we right now? And what would a second term, what would a second Trump Barr term be like?
Well, I'm reluctant to bar a resignation, but if you tell me to, I'll assume that it isn't going to happen. I actually think it's a realistic.
Really? Okay.
I think it's a realistic possibility if segments of the public will now respond to the situation. I think that the reference to even Trump voters is significant because one of the things about a lot of the folks that voted for President Trump, I think, is that they have an inherent suspicion, and some of it's justified. They have an inherent suspicion of concentrations of power. They have a healthy disrespect for concentrating too much power in one place. It's in a way that particular sentiment, although little else about the Trump agenda, is reflective of an, as you would agree, I think, a traditional conservative Republican inclination that we got to be careful what we do and we don't want to put too much power in any one place, among other things. And I am kind of just head spinning aghast that, and maybe I'm hopeful that people, when they actually dwell on the reality here, what the reality is, don't, you know, we say one thing and we get angry at a lot of people and we attract some supporters by blaming people for things. And there's a lot of things happening. But if you look behind the curtain and you look at what's going on is an effort that Bill Barr is the master of, to concentrate almost complete governmental power in one person. And I don't know anybody. I mean, that is about as un-American as anything can be. We are suspicious of concentrations of power in America. And I think Trump voters are mostly suspicious of concentrations of power. So I'm kind of, I guess I'm aghast that they wouldn't care. And I'm hopeful that they will care. when they understand, if they do understand, that this is what these people are up to.
Well, they've swallowed a lot so far, and they've accepted things that we would have thought were being unacceptable in the past. So let's take my pessimistic, okay, skeptical, okay, line here, yeah, just for, yeah, for the sake of argument. What does this mean for a Trump bar second term? Because I have to say that, as alarming as what we're having now, a president who's been acquitted and reelected, who clearly feels that he has no limits on his power, who has a Bill Barr whispering in his ear that he is not limited by any constitutional restraints, doesn't have to be afraid of impeachment. What? Because, I mean, we're not at a point where we've hit bottom yet, have we? I mean, it can be worse.
Oh, much worse. Yeah. No, I mean, I think there's a bunch of things that are underway now that are things that are being litigated and things that are being asserted in terms of gutting checks and balances in various ways. And some of those may well work their way up to the Supreme Court. For example, we have coming up in March, the Supreme Court's going to hear three cases related to this whole issue of stonewalling Congress and whether Congress has the right, and also whether the Attorney General of the state of New York has the right to subpoena information and get it, or whether they can just be stiffed in the summary way that the that essentially the administration has done and Bill Barr has helped to cause it to happen. And, you know, one of the questions is, okay, how do those issues, when they make it, the ones that make it to the Supreme Court, how do they turn out? We have a Supreme Court now that has two Trump appointees on it. I don't know what you know from that. It's hard to say for sure. Are we optimistic, or what do we think they will do? Are they going to stand up for the system of checks and balances? Are they going to reaffirm the traditions of our old system? Boy, I sure hope so. I don't think it's a sure bet. I think it's probably more likely than not they will, but I don't know. So part of it depends on the courts being allowed to function. Now, one thing I think I said earlier, maybe I didn't, but one of the big pieces that Barr sees when he gave this speech to the Federalist Society in November, he devoted a third of it. He devoted the last third of it to attacking the courts and to attacking the role the courts have played in essentially the traditional role of deciding intergovernment disputes, of resolving what the checks and balances really mean, of, you know, deciding complex and difficult legal issues that involve judgment calls, which is pretty much all the Supreme Court ever does. So those sorts of things are rolling along. Ultimately, I think the question is, are we going to get kind of protection from our court system, or are they going to be able to subvert it? Is the Supreme Court going to stand up when it's given the chance? Of course, it only gets the chance in certain individual isolated cases. But failing that and assuming, I mean, the worst case scenario would be reelection and winning the Senate. And I suppose, I don't think it'll happen, but even winning the House. If they have a functioning majority in this country in general, then I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to say that our basic system of democracy is going to collapse. I don't know how long that will take. But their ability to undermine these checks and balances means they have a huge amount of power to simply act summarily in a lot of cases. And I guess one simple way to visualize it would be just to extrapolate on what's going on now with these criminal cases. You know, think about that. So the president now is going to be able, if all of this goes forward the way he would like, then his ability to weigh in and in terms of decisions in a very personal way to totally terminate the norm that he's separate and stays out of those kinds of cases. And so you have cases for his friends, which we're looking at now. And then what about the cases involving his enemies? How about that? How do we all feel about that? Do we really want that? Do we want him to be able to, he can fire Alexander Vindman. Do we really want him to be able to prosecute someone because somebody used his conscience and stood up and spoke out in an honest way?
There is an element of Trump world that is, you know, is rooting for that.
Absolutely.
Which is interesting that you actually, I mean, you do have a constituency for, you know, you have the power, you need to protect your friends, and you need to punish your enemies. So we're waiting on the federal courts to see what they will do. Going back to the Department of Justice, now you know this. There's these 2,000 letters, 2,000 signatures on these letters from former DOJ employees. One of the most dramatic things that could happen, of course, would be that if Barr and the president push the limits too far, is there any prospect of, and I'm using this as an imprecise term, mass resignations from the Department of Justice if he were to intervene and say, I want you to drop the Rudy Giuliani investigation? Would there be significant, you know, a number of folks from the SDNY who would just say, we're just not going to be part of all of that? Because that would get people's attention. That would be dramatic.
I think it's possible. I mean, I have no inside information about it. And I think those kinds of decisions are very personal and very difficult to make. And you know, you always have to deal with the question of, you know, you're doing very important work. And the balance of the cost-benefit analysis in terms of do I do more for the country by staying and doing my work, or I'm at a point where I have to resign? It's a hard call, and people have to make it. And I'm not here to beat the drum and say everybody ought to quit, because I think that's not probably responsible. But
and it's always asking easy whether it's always easy to talk about other people losing their jobs and putting their careers at risk. It's a much more difficult choice for people who have mortgages and kids in college and careers to protect.
But if you're asking whether it could happen, I think it could happen. Yeah, I mean, I don't know about mass resignations, but I can see principled individuals who might well reach a point in certain situations where they just say, I can't stand it anymore, and that could happen. I think it could, and I do think I don't have, you know, a lot of personal insight into the state of mind of people in the department right now. I could speculate about it. My guess is there's a fair amount of distress being felt there, and I feel for the people there, because I know how much pride, when I was there, I know how much pride people took in this role that is inherent in trying to do the right thing, trying to be fair, trying to make sure people know you're trying to be fair, and trying to do everything you can to avoid the appearance that somebody, even the appearance that somebody might wrongly think that someone got a raw deal or someone got a special break. These are things that Justice Department lawyers think about a lot, and they work very hard, and they take a huge amount of pride when they stand up and say they represent the United States. And that's because the United States has stood for truth and honorable pursuits, and I just would hate like hell to see that lost.
Thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Donald Ayer served as U.S. Attorney and Principal Deputy Solicitor General in the Reagan administration and as Deputy Attorney General under George H.W. Bush. And this is just a much talked about piece in The Atlantic that he wrote, that Bill Barr must resign. And thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Appreciate it very much, Mr. Ayer.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.